Brian, you're very welcome to the ScaleX Insider podcast. I'm really thrilled and delighted to have you on the show today.
Brendan, thanks so much for having me on. I'm really looking forward to chatting.
Yeah, likewise. Our vision is to inspire, connect, and enable millions of ambitious leaders of small and medium-sized enterprises to scale with purpose. So what does scaling with purpose mean to you?
For me, there's a quote that I attach to when I think about scaling with purpose, and that is don't forget the flowers at your feet when you're reaching for the moon. And that's how I feel when I think about scaling with purpose. It's not losing yourself and not losing what's valuable to you as you grow your business, as you grow your impact, and as you grow your service in the world, and just constantly checking back in with who you need to be for all the people around you and the service that you provide, but just don't get caught in the mix as you grow and scale.
I love that. I've never heard that quote before. That's beautiful. So if you have the name, or I'll Google it afterwards, but it's a lovely, lovely quote. I want to put something in context for you, because I have read your wonderful book, Rewire Your Mindset. The challenge with scaling, actually currently in the UK alone, less than 1% of the 5.7 million SMEs achieve scale. And incredibly, a lack of ambition is cited as the single greatest impediment as to why so few companies scale. You open your book in the first chapter with a beautiful quote: "I would never have been able to achieve any outward success if I wasn't inwardly in control of what I thought, did, or said. And I had to learn to do all of that." So I'd really love us to do a mini masterclass today of all of those key learnings. But before we do, you've been on an incredible journey of both personal and professional scaling over the last 10 years. And for those who don't know Brian Keane, can you give us a little bit of background to your story, Brian, and maybe touch on some of the influences for this wonderful book?
Yeah, so my kind of elevator pitch in terms of my backstory, Brendan, was I was a primary school teacher. That was my quote-unquote job. It was my what was supposed to be my career. And I did that kind of what a lot of people do when they're starting off, when they don't think entrepreneurship or scaling up a business or growing a business is even something they could potentially do. It wasn't even in my radar. I never thought about it. It was go to college, get a degree, get a job. You work that job for 40, 50 years, you retire, you die. Like, for the lack of a better way of putting it, that's the trajectory I was on. And I did my 4 years, which was an undergraduate in business, which served me a lot and actually helped me a lot. And my postgraduate was in primary school teaching. And then I walked into a job in London just as a male teacher into sport. I literally had a pick of jobs. I just chose which one I wanted. And I was about half an hour into my first every day of teaching. And it was a year three class, so 10-year-olds, 19-year-olds. And I sat there thinking, I don't want to be a teacher. What am I doing here? I was like, I've spent the last 5 years getting an undergraduate degree, a postgraduate degree. I've moved country. I'm living in London and I'm in this job that I don't want to be in. And it kind of was the original awakening that got me thinking about, this isn't how I can spend the rest of my life. I can't do this for another 50 years. And I came home that Christmas and I was talking to my mom, who was and still is my biggest fan with everything I do to this day.
Brilliant.
And she asked me, I was having a nice little pity party for myself, Brendan. I was like, oh, I hate my job. I can't believe I did this. I've wasted all this time, energy, and money. What am I doing? And she put a question to me that I put in Rewire Your Mindset, the book you mentioned, and I put on my channels regularly. And she asked, what would you do for free? And I never thought about that question. And it just didn't even dawn on me. And I sat there and I thought, I would work in a gym for free. I would clean the floors in a gym. If I got to be in the gym environment, I would do that for free. And then I kind of pulled on that thread and it led me to, okay, well, actually, how could you potentially get a career in this? So I started to look into personal training and I went back to London that January. I signed up to a fitness instructor course. And then over the space of the next year and a half, I got all my certificates for personal training, fitness instructor, sports nutrition. And for 2 years, I did both. I worked as a teacher during the day and I worked as a personal trainer in a gym at nighttime. And it got to the point when I was getting paid for personal training sessions in the gym in London. Now I've scaled since, which I'll get onto, but people were paying me £30, £40, £50 an hour, depending on the package. And I was like, I can't believe I'm getting paid for this. I was like, this is unbelievable. And it made me follow that course because you had to pay me to teach. Like, if you didn't pay me, there was no way I was going to teach a class on Monday morning. There was just no way it was happening. But I was on this opposite end of the spectrum in this other job where I would have done it for free. And over 2 years, I started to learn my craft. And in 2014, I made the transition and the jump back to Ireland. So I moved back to Galway, the west of Ireland, moved back in with my mum and dad. My sister gave me her crappy little Toyota Yaris, a car that was as old as me. One of those that, like, when you close the front door, all the windows fall down. And it was one of those, but it worked. Like, it got me to where I needed to be 80, 90% of the time. I always had like jumper cables in the back just to be safe. And so I had that in 2014. And I said, I'm going to give myself a 6 month runway of time to try and get this one-to-one personal training business off the ground. And if I don't make enough to live, I'll go back teaching in September. That was my timeline that I gave myself, that self-imposed timeline. And it exploded in a positive way. Over the space of 6 months, now I must preface, and a lot of people who are entrepreneurs and business owners will know this, once you've learned your craft, that's sometimes the hardest part, because you can give up when you're not good at what you do. Now, I'd learned my craft in London, so I was a good personal trainer. I was good with fitness. I understood my biomechanics. I understood nutrition. And I started to spiral with clients in a positive way. More people started to come in. I had to hire a second trainer to actually work with the waiting list that I built up over the 6 months. And then over the next year and a half, I was building up this business of what was going to be a kind of a franchise of a Brian Keane fitness brand, where I took personal trainers under my umbrella and they took clients. And it was a very profitable model. It worked really, really well. I had several trainers under me, but I started to see social media growing, and my daughter was going to be born in 2015. And I thought that all this time, energy, and effort I'm putting into my trainers and this brand isn't very leverageable. It's like, I can set people up, but I still have to manage them. And I was designing that model and decided, do you know what? Social media is starting to take off here. I'm starting to build up an Instagram following. I'm starting to build up a Facebook following. I could potentially do something online. And I gave myself another window of time where I said, right, I'll set up all my trainers. I had a revenue stream coming in, so I was able to remove myself from the business. I was just managing personal trainers. And I said, I'm going to give myself a 6 month runway of creating content only online. And then I'm going to sell an online program at the end of it and see if this works. And if it works, I'll double down on it and I'll keep going with it. So for 6 months, I went Instagram, Facebook, 2-3 pieces of content every day for 6 months. And then at the end of those 6 months, I went hard selling on an online program. And that online program was, at the time, I put 50 people into an online program. I sold it at €100 at a discount. And I opened it with a click pay now link in 2016 for PayPal. And it was the first time that I opened it at 12 o'clock. By 12:05, I had just under $5,000 in my account. And I sat there and thought, I've been doing this wrong all the time. I was like, I've been trading time for money. I've been doing all this effort into potentially the wrong part of my business, whereas I should be scaling and leveraging my time so that I can earn more. And from that point on, that was my awakening when it came to business. That was the summer of 2016. And I, from that point, just kept growing and scaling from that point onward. So where we are now is we have our online programs. We've got evergreen courses. I do a lot of corporate speaking. I've got books. And then we've got our small team that I try and keep quite condensed and small, very much that company of one philosophy. We've got our four people full time and then our freelancers that we work with. And we've got our version of scale. So my version of scale now looks like my time back. So I have I tell my mastermind clients this all the time. They're like, Jesus, how does that happen? Like, I only work about 15 hours a week. Like, I have a very time leveraged week, you know, and we do well with our business, multiple six figures every year from the different revenue streams we have and the faucets we can pull. And I'm always trying to keep that balance, because we could come to me, and I've thought about this, we could go to our seven figures. We'd need a plan and probably a 2-year run to do it. But it means that 15 hours would probably go back to 50, 60 hours, you know, because you'd be selling your time. And it's not the balance I want. So I try and keep this balancing act so that I can spend time with my daughter. She's 7. spend time with my partner, my loved ones, my family members. I can do all the fitness stuff, the training for ultras and marathons and gyms and things that I like to do. So it's this fine balance that I'm constantly trying to keep going. And that's my version of scale. I suppose it's slightly different even the first answer, but that's what the scale for my business looks like at the minute.
There's so much in that and it's incredible. And I encourage anyone who's listening to the podcast, whenever you get off the podcast, Google this man, go into Instagram, and you're going to see one of the leanest jacked people that I have ever met. This guy is in serious shape. And in terms of scaling, Brian, I mean, just to put it in context, and I love the idea that you give yourself these time horizons to test it. You know, you've now, 120,000 Instagram followers. You know your craft, my friend. I mean, I listen to your podcast, regular listener to your podcast. You are incredibly knowledgeable. I used to gift the Fitness Mindset, your very first book. Again, I love the book. And what, you know, when we come back to the question of knowing your craft, what I discern from reading your book, the Rewire Your Mindset, is you're so incredibly well read. I mean, I see influences in there from Stephen Covey, Robert Sharma, Richard Feynman, the Stoics, Paulo Coelho, Robert Kawasaki, Bob Proctor. I was kind of, this guy is so well read. How important do you think reading is, or do you feel reading is, in terms of scaling, and what role has reading played in your scaling journey to date?
I genuinely think reading is the secret weapon to scaling and to long-term success. I think anybody that is looking to grow in whatever that looks like for you, grow, scale, either your impact, your following, your revenue, reading is the secret sauce that cuts the learning curve. And there's not a coincidence that I read very, very few books, because I'm a vivacious reader now. I read a lot of books and my library is probably up there as big as anybody's. But I didn't read a lot until I was about 24. And it's not a coincidence that I struggled with my business at 24. I struggled with a lot of other elements of my life around that time because I was trying to figure it all out myself. And I think it's a Brandon Mull quote that, you know, the sharp people learn from the mistakes, the really sharp ones learn from the mistakes of others. And books give you that. They give you the insights and mistakes other people make so you don't have to make them yourself. There's no avoiding mistakes. And if anything, I actually think mistakes are a great thing. Failure is feedback. It's not an end product. It's an absolute must and an ingredient of success on any entrepreneurial journey. But you do want to limit the amount of mistakes you make. And you also want to minimize the impact that those mistakes have. You don't want to do anything that's catastrophic. Like, it's the same as, you know, we talked about the Wim Hof breathing before we went on air. At that, like, Wim Hof is incredible and the method is amazing. And I used it when I was running through the Arctic in 2019. But 10 minutes a day on that makes you feel incredible. It bumps your sex drive. You feel immune function. 50 minutes a day, 2 hours a day, if you're not Wim Hof, could kill you. So the danger is in the dose. And that's the same thing with the mistakes you make in your business. It depends on the amount of time and the amount of scale that those potential mistakes have. And reading cuts down that level of mistakes and the impact that they have when you do make them. And then you can learn from them. And I read very widely. Like, one of my, and I don't, won't say inspirations are an idol, because I don't think you should idolize people, although you can take inspiration from them. Like Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett's business partner. I've read Poor Charlie's Almanac 15, 16 times. Like, it's just a book that I just reread and reread and reread and reread. And, you know, Charlie's in his 90s now, I think. And his jokes, his kids and grandkids joke that he's like a because he's always sitting down reading a book, that he's like a book with four legs. And I love that. And he talks about, you know, learning from other people. And I embody that, or try to embody that in my own life, and read very eclectically. So I'll read in the sciences, I'll read in economics, I'll read business, I'll read the Stoics, I'll read philosophy, because you're learning and pulling different information. And Charlie Munger has a theory that you don't need to learn anything new. You can go over to a different discipline, take the message from that discipline and just apply it in your own life. Like, I've used countless times in my program and on my podcast, I've talked about opportunity costs. Now, opportunity costs, as your listeners will probably know, and you'll know, Brendan, is, you know, it's an economics term that if you spend a euro or a pound on a packet of crisps, you can't spend that same euro or pound on a water. And I bring that to my clients all the time, that there's an opportunity cost for the food choices you make. There's an opportunity cost for the amount of time you spend with a specific person. So every time you say yes to something, you're saying no to something else. And that transitions and crosses into other areas of your life. I didn't learn that or come up with that. I'm not smart enough to do that. I literally took it from a different discipline and just applied it in my own fields. And books can give you that. And it allows you to, particularly in my field, where I have a lot of social media, podcasts, I'm just taking ideas from other people. There hasn't been an original idea in 10,000 years. You're just taking ideas from other people and putting your own spin on it to hopefully connect with the people you're trying to influence.
Yeah, I love that. And I'm going to credit my economic teacher with the fact that I know the definition of opportunity cost, the benefit obtained from the next most desirable alternative foregone because of sector choice. So credit to Mr. Jerry Cullen there for that. It was what I picked up from my economics class 30 years ago, and it still stands me in good judgment these days, because ultimately, if you're saying yes to something, you're saying no to something else. And when we come to vision and having a vision and crafting a vision, this is so critically important, because ultimately a vision not only tells you what you should say yes to and inform your decisions about what you're saying yes to, but critically important actually, what you should filter out and say no to. I often talk about scaling in the context of kind of climbing a mountain, and that visual of being at the base camp and getting to the summit of what we call Scale Everest. And I also, you know, I assert to all of the CEOs that are going through our program, and the Wim Hof method is integrated within our program, because I'm passionate about this, that you have only achieved successful scaling and scaling with purpose if actually you reach the summit of Scale Everest and you're in good physical health, you're in good mental health, and your relationships are intact. And whilst you have been challenged going, you know, summiting Scale Everest, which is what we should be in order to grow, we should be rightfully challenged, but your health shouldn't be compromised along the way, and your relationships shouldn't be compromised along the way. So, you know, you describe four quadrants in your book, which I really like in terms of kind of achieving or a full scaling life, both in a personal sense and professional sense. Can you share with us, Brian, those four quadrants?
The four quadrants are, for me, health, wealth, love, and fulfillment. And the reason I came up with those, so if you picture four quadrants, you've got health in one, physical health, your mental health, you've got your wealth in another, your bank account, your how your business is running, you've got your love, your relationships, romantic, family, etc. And then your fulfillment, the things that light you up. So for me, it's book writing, running endurance races, etc., the things that make me feel fulfilled. So understanding the success is very subjective, so you need to get clear on what that looks like for you. But those four quadrants, they say that, you know, the invention is the mother of necessity, or necessity is the mother of invention. And that's what happened to me, because I have a tendency to go micro tunnel vision when I'm setting out to hit a goal. And this can be really helpful and can be really useful depending on the context. So if I was trying to build my business, and these are examples that were in my own life, or if I was preparing for, I used to compete in bodybuilding shows, I used to be a professional fitness model doing those competitions before I moved into the world of endurance. And that type A tunnel vision is really useful for external success generally, because it means that you can put the blinkers on and just go. That's all well and good if nothing else in your life is important to you. But if you do have other things in your life that are important to you, you need some form of system that allows you to check in with those other elements. And what happened to me, and I had my big wake-up moment, Brendan, in, I think it was 2017, maybe 2016. It was before the first book came out, so 2016. That was my first really successful financial year. It's when we kind of grew online, first multiple six-figure year, massive profit because our overheads were low. And I was really riding high on my own supply. I thought I was the bomb. Like, I was like, yeah, I was like, look at my bank account. I'm awesome, you know, pride before the fall. And I had a conversation with my mom. I spoke about this in Rewire Your Mindset. So my mom was working in insurance. She worked all her life from 18 to in her late 50s. And we went for coffee. And she was complaining about her job. And she's like, oh my God, I have to go back to work now. And she was just in this. And my mom never complains. She never moans, never complains, but was really fed up of her job. And I said, do you know what? I need somebody to do a little bit of work task for me, send out some packages, come work for me. And I thought in that moment, I'm the best son ever. I am amazing. I'm literally Billy Big Balls. Good job, Brian. You're the best son. They're going to send accolades and awards to your house. Good job. Well done. And that was fine. 6 months later, after my mom working with me and for me, I had been very stressed. I was launching a couple of new programs. I was writing the first book. I was very stressed and wasn't very aware or self-aware in how I was being with the people around me, as what can happen sometimes in a journey when you become tunnel vision. I remember my mom sat me down when I was back at her house for dinner, and she was like, "I'm going to go back working my job in insurance." And I was like, "What?" I was like, "Why would you go back working your job in insurance? You hated that." And she was like, "Look," she goes, "you haven't spoken to me. We haven't had any conversation." She goes, "I feel like you're mad at me all the time." And I sat there and my heart sank into my mouth. And I was like, fuck. And I had this thought on how have I been the last 6 months? And I couldn't pull any image of me being fully present or being really switched on. And I was taking out, and it was only because my mom was around me more, I was just lashing out, because we tend to lash out on the people that are around us. That's the nature of an inability to handle stress. And I said, give me a month. I was like, I will change. I was like, this is my issue. I will change. I was like, give me a month. If it's still a problem in a month, you can go back and work your job in insurance. So she said, okay. And then over the next month, I brought on another employee. I got better with my outsourcing. I got very good with eliminating, delegating, and automating parts of my business. And I was able to take back some of my control when it came to my stress management. And I felt less stressed and I was more present when I was there with my mom and had those knockover effects with other people in my life. And it was off the back of that, I developed the four quadrants, because I just got completely unbalanced in my pursuit of a number for my business, which actually didn't make any difference. Like, this is the weird paradox. When you get out of escape velocity within an online business, you can keep your overheads quite low. So the difference between 100 grand a year, 200 grand a year, and 300 grand a year is very little. You can hire an extra employee. They might do a little bit of extra work, but like, the net difference is very different. It's not much. You pay a little bit extra tax, obviously, but like, there's nothing extra really, because you don't have those overheads. And I was looking for that sweet spot and that balance in the business. How many hours a week versus the revenue and the income? So I started to set up more evergreen businesses. I set up a lot of good sales funnels that generate good leads on the background, a lot of brand and content marketing for bringing good people into programs, etc. But I also looked at the other areas of my life that were important to me. My health, my mental health, my physical health, my relationships, as I said, and that fulfillment level. I wasn't really doing anything that was keeping me fulfilled at that time. So that four quadrant got built out of that. And a lot of entrepreneurs, weirdly, because I didn't necessarily write that book for business people, but a lot of business people and entrepreneurs love Rewire Your Mindset for that reason, because they're like, oh my God, I see myself in your story, in some version of it, where they get hyper-focused and start to, you know, lose the flowers at their feet when they're reaching for the moon, to keep the analogy and keep the metaphor of earlier. And that was something that I had to put a plan in place around and check in with regularly. And I still do it to this day, where I'll look in and go, okay, I use a 1 to 10 scale. How was I today in my health or my wealth or my love or my fulfillment? And it's fine to be out of balance. There'll be times in your life when you're training for a marathon and you'll, you know, potentially be training way harder and it'll be taking from other areas. And there'll be times when there's a death in a family, you know, where you have to spend a lot of time with loved ones and business has to go on hold for a while. And there'll be times when you're launching a program or a product or a book, and that becomes priority. It's just not to let it become too out of alignment for too long. And that four quadrant just gives you a little bit of a check-in with it.
Yeah, I love it. And for me, I love the structure of it and the clarity and simplicity of it. But it's incredibly, incredibly profound, even that you share examples of your own goals and the questions that you ask around those goals in terms of scoring yourself. And just curious, do you have someone who holds you accountable? Do you have your own coach?
No, but there's self-awareness on my part here as well. I don't struggle to hold myself accountable in most areas of my life, particularly business and fitness. Yeah. They're two that I'm just good. Now, I have relationships. You talk to my partner, I have to be accountable to her. If I'm disassociating or disconnecting because I'm feeling triggered or whatever, she'll call me on it. So she keeps me accountable in our relationship. But when it comes to business and fitness, they're not areas. Now, I'm a big believer in mentors. If you need a mentorship, mastermind, online courses, programs, like what you need, if you need the accountability, you should work with a coach. But you should be self-aware enough to know that I actually don't need the accountability in this area of my life. And the same goes for the gym and working out. Some people need a fitness coach to keep them accountable. I never did and never do just because it's not my area of weakness. You tell me what I need to do and I'll do it. And business is the same. So personally, I don't. But that's not to say don't.
Just before we get into some of the practicalities, as you see them, of developing a really resilient, robust mindset and a mindset for scaling, just something you mentioned there, and given your experience and significant experience now in developing online courses and scaling your business online, you know, you've tested social media platforms. You know, you started very green to all of this and you're now incredibly savvy. You have a huge online following and, you know, you have a presence across lots of different platforms, including an incredible podcast. What would you recommend to listeners? And there'd be listeners, you know, leading very small businesses to those, you know, multi-million pound businesses, various different levels of maturity in terms of their use of social media. But just in terms of the development of social media to aid their business, what advice would you share with our listeners in relation to the use of social media to drive what you refer to kind of leads into the top of the funnel?
I think when you see social media as a tool for your business, it allows you to remove some of your own subjective opinion around it. And that same logic applies for regardless of platform. And I generally get pushback from business owners, small business owners, big business owners, entrepreneurs, coaches, a lot of the people that I work with when it comes to business work, that, you know, I can't go on this platform because I'm too old. So yeah. I can't go on TikTok. I'm in my 30s. I'm in my 40s. And my answer to that is always, well, if you remove your opinion from this, would you be doing it? And the answer is normally, well, I don't know. And it just opens up that dialogue. And when you start to see social media as a tool, and it's a very powerful tool for bringing in those top of funnel sales, particularly for an online business, I think it works for offline too. But when you think of Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Facebook, I'd probably lob a podcast in there as well to a degree, in a blog, because it's still media, it's social media, it's permissionless content that anybody that can put out content on it, and you can leverage it for time for the most part, particularly podcast, blogs, but some social as well. TikTok in particular has a long tail end. That helps to build up your brand. And I was on a webinar earlier today about recession-proofing your coaching business. And I finished it off with, if you have a brand, recessions don't become a problem. And because when people like, know, and trust you, and you've put out enough content, you have one authority so that you can continually sell even when times are quote unquote bad, but you also have price control. And it means you don't have to drop your price to try and bring people in, especially if you're selling a service. Now, I have a lot of scale programs as well, 100% evergreen, but the same idea applies. That price control is based on the attachment of your name and brand to it. And when you start to price yourself like, you know, milk and eggs, you're not a commodity, that becomes a problem. And a lot of people forget that social media is a fast way to build up that brand awareness by putting out content in your area of expertise and bridging that gap between, I don't know who you are, I have an expert level of knowledge on this particular topic, and bridging that gap between the two people. It's that marketing bridge and bringing them over from one side to the other. And social media gives you that in a very short period of time. Like, I've had people, particularly when you're understanding algorithms and how they change on social, I have one guy I'm working with at the minute who's building up a GA endurance business, and he went from zero followers, didn't even have a TikTok account. I said, set up your TikTok and start putting out GA specific content for endurance athletes who are in that merge in between. And he started to build up. He's only got a few thousand followers now, but he has leads coming into the top of his coaching program because it gets it in front of people who don't know who you are. And it's a short period of time, because what happens with social is people will start to get that brand recognition. You'll start popping up on the feed, and automatically you become an authority when you're speaking on a particular topic. Podcasts are also extremely powerful for this. I think you know this already, Brendan. Like, the consumption behavior and psychological consumption of people on podcasts is so much more different compared to social media. It's why it's such an effective top of funnel sales tool. Somebody could hear about my podcast, and I have over 400 episodes on the Brian Keene podcast. Somebody could hear about my podcast on a Wednesday. They could listen to an episode on a Thursday. They could binge three or four episodes on a Friday or Saturday and have signed up to a program by Monday, because it builds, it's a one-way direction. It's building up a lot of trust in a very short period of time. It's an intimate platform that they can double over with something else. And it builds up this, I don't know who you are, Brian Keane, to, oh my God, I need this guy's program in 3 or 4 days because of the consumption behavior. People tend to binge podcasts like they binge Netflix series. And then before I know it, somebody who didn't know who I was on a Tuesday or Wednesday has signed up to a program or a course on Monday. And that happens over and over and over and over again. And that's why a podcast in particular is so powerful. But something similar happens on social media. It's just you don't have as long of a tail end compared to podcasts where people will go back on a back catalog.
I love that. You're just so knowledgeable in so many different areas that you've given real value, real gold there to our listeners, Brian, in relation to social media. In the kernel of that is mindset. And I hear this time and time again from the CEOs who are going through our own program who are reluctant even to put their business onto LinkedIn for fear of competitors finding out, you know, a little bit more about them and fear of putting themselves out there. This is all about mindset. So let's get into this because you address this in your book. What is fear and how do we overcome it in the context of developing a mindset for scaling?
I love the acronym for fear, false evidence appearing real. That's the one that I always bring it back to. And fear is so funny because we tend to have domain dependence on fear, which still blows my mind to this day that we all do it. It's obviously a cognitive bias that we all have that I'm unaware of, that we'll be fearful in one situation and we won't take context for when we were fearful in one situation and apply it to another. This blows my mind, meaning that you might be extremely outgoing in a club on a Saturday night, but you're terrified to post on Instagram. Or you have no problem having a 2-hour conversation on a podcast, but you will not ask your boss for a raise. Like there's the domain dependence fear. And what I encourage people to consider is that you should anchor times in the past when you were afraid to help you deal with the current fear that you're dealing with now. And I use the example in the book of when I ran Marathon des Sables, which is 6 back-to-back marathons through the Sahara Desert in 2018. Now, I was terrified, Brendan, before that. Like, literally, you gave me a good out a week before I had taken it. I was terrified, didn't want to go, was really afraid of doing that based on a whole host of my own fears, etc., and experience with running as someone that went from GEA playing sports to bodybuilding to marathon running and ultra marathon running. So I had a lot of fear around it. But then when I went to run the Arctic a year later, which is subsequently considerably harder than the Sahara, I used the time and the fear that I had in Marathon des Sables in the Sahara to be like, well, look, you got through that, you'll get through this. And even now, you know, when my last book came out, The Keen Edge, I had a lot of TV appearances, big promotion around it. And there was times when I'd get nervous before I was on Ireland AM or whatever it was. And I would just sit and breathe and go, okay, you got through the Arctic. You got through Marathon des Sables. You'll be fine on a 10-minute interview on TV. It's cool. You'll be okay. And you're using times in the past, as I call them fear anchors in the book, times in the past when you were afraid to deal with times that you're afraid currently. The one that most people can connect with. Some people it will be, you know, exams, etc. But like, think of the first time you ever kissed a guy or a girl. Like, that was terrifying and literally the biggest deal of all time the first time it happened. Like, the world may as well have stopped the first time I kissed a girl because I was like, oh my God. And then after what happened, and I remember my first kiss, I was 11, she was 12, in a hotel room in Kerry, and I remember thinking, oh my God, my heart was pounding like it was going to go out of my chest. I was like, what do we do? And after it, I thought, what was the big deal? And most fearful situations are like that. They're only scary until you've done them. And then when you've done them, they become your new normal. And most people now will take for granted that they kiss their partner or their boyfriend or their girlfriend every day, potentially, if they're lucky. Or at some point they've kissed somebody and they don't even think about it. And that's what happens with fear. It reframes and becomes your new normal. And you just want to get yourself conditioned to the point where that thing that once had you fearful and afraid is now your new normal. And you just keep pushing the bar on that until you get the things you want.
How important then, Brian, is vision in this in terms of actually getting out of your own head and crafting something that you hope exists beyond you and that ultimately you're serving and you recognize and acknowledge that it's really important for you to do this thing because it's aligned to your overall vision. Is that been your experience or what else do you use to actually nudge you over that wall of terror?
It's a very interesting question. And I've got, because my answer on it has changed in more recent years. And I think vision's absolutely key. I think clarity is power, and you need to know what it is you're looking to do. You can't hit a target you can't see. So you need to have the vision on what it looks like. You don't need to know how you're going to get there, but you need to know what you're looking to achieve. Yeah. It's the same as, like, you wouldn't get in your car and drive from Armagh to Galway without knowing, well, actually, I'm getting in the car to drive to Galway. How do I get there? You'd have some semblance that this is where I want to go. I'll figure out how to get there. But having just randomly not striving for a goal, it's like hopping in your car expecting to go somewhere and then be like, well, you didn't set it in destination on the GPS. Don't, you're like, you're stuck in Wicklow now. Like, what do you think was going to happen? Or you're stuck in York, or you're stuck in Newcastle. Like, that's what happens. And sometimes people start that journey and they're not very clear on where they want to go. I'm like, you don't need to know how you're going to get there. Just be clear on where you want to go. But it's interesting, when I wrote Rewire Your Mindset, that's my favorite book. I've written 4 books, 3 bestsellers, and Rewire Your Mindset is my favorite by far. It's the one that's the most personal to me. And it was the one that, in a very weird way, because this is true and it sounds morbid when I say it, but that was the book that I wrote that I wanted to leave behind in case anything ever happened to me and I wanted to leave something for my daughter. That's, I wrote that book in that place. So in my writing mode, like they always say, write to a person. Like I was writing to my daughter if something ever happened to me, in just a kind of an instruction manual, and this is how you need to think, this is how you should live your life, go be the best version of you. So it put me into that place. So I'm very close to that book compared to the others, which had different purposes. All my books had intention and purpose, but that was what Rewire Your Mindset had. So when I wrote that, I wasn't thinking about legacy for anyone else. I was thinking about, well, what can I leave behind the person who means the most to me? And I put myself in that position when I wrote. And in more recent years, it's changed, because I did have that philosophy of, I want to leave the world better because I was here. And I still have that. But I'm less focused on it, and I'm way more intentional about my immediate surroundings, my partner, my daughter, my loved ones, my inner circle, and just making sure that I'm spending time with them, I'm present when I'm with them. And all the other stuff is what I call focusing on the process. And I'm like the worst person to ask, and I know it's one of the questions you might ask me at the end when people are like, well, what's next? And I'm the worst person to ask that question, because I have targets and I have goals that I'm working towards, but I will pivot and change something straight away if it's not aligning with my authentic self and who I want to be and how I'm showing up with the people closest to me. And I'm weirdly, from this conversation, I'm like the king of quitters, and people always weirdly react when I say that. And I tell people that quitting is fine. Don't quit because something's too hard. That's fucking stupid. Like, if it's too hard, get more resilient, get stronger, add more tools. You can do it. You're stronger than you think. But quitting because something's wrong and misaligned with who you want to be is a good idea. I think that's a really good idea. You know, some of the relationships I've been in the past, best thing I ever did was leave them. Yeah. I left my teaching job, one of the best decisions I ever made. I quit both. And I think rewiring that and asking yourself that question can be helpful. And when it comes to vision and what I want over the long term, it's so hard to ask, well, what's next? Because as long as I'm enjoying the process of jumping out of bed every day, that's my metric for success. Am I jumping out of bed because I'm excited about the day ahead? As long as that's happening, more often than not, I just keep going on what is. And I do have my targets. I literally have my goals for the year, goals for 6 months, goals for 3 months. I do have targets that I'm always working towards, but I'm not super attached to them, because if at any point I feel it's the wrong direction, or it's not paying off, or it's not what I really want to do, I'll change it. So I think I'm not, as I said, I can't add the most value on that. I can only tell you what's true for me, but that's how I see it.
Yeah, I think you have added a lot of value to that, in terms of the importance of vision, in terms of having that clear North Star, that understanding of where you want to go, but actually ensuring that it's anchored and your reason for going is anchored back to your values. So just picking up on that for a moment, Brian, because the process of actually uncovering your values, was that something where you've sat down on an afternoon and go, right, okay, I'm going to clarify my values, or, you know, do you know your values? Clearly you do. What process have you gone through to arrive at your values?
When it comes to identifying values, the first step for me, and I can only offer kind of my own anecdotal experience, was defining what values meant to me. And that sounds really obvious, or maybe not so obvious, depending on starting point. But I had a lot of junk values in my life, meaning that things I was spending time and attention on that in hindsight, looking back, were junk values. I had a lot. When I use how I looked is a really good example of this. As someone that was in the bodybuilding world, fitness modeling world, in the fitness world, I had a huge portion of my self-worth tied to how I looked. So as long as I looked a certain way, my body composition was a certain way, I felt good about myself. And when I started to flip that and move out of that, the same thing happened with my net worth in terms of my self-worth was tied to my net worth. I felt good as long as I was making 20, 30, 40K a month. I'm like, as long as I'm making this, I'm like, I'm good. My self-worth's tied to this. And you can only be hit metaphorically or figuratively with a hammer in the head so often before you wonder why your head is hurting. And I kept feeling so empty at the back of these, when I would be earning this amount of money. And again, it's ironic because in 2022, we earn very good revenue in our business per month. I'm in good shape in terms of subjective or objective shape, in terms of body fat's low, lean muscle tissue is relatively high. But there's no attachment to those things. I'm not super attached to them. It's part of the process. I live a certain way, so I look a certain way. I provide a certain amount of service, so I earn a certain revenue. And that's what kind of keeps spiraling in the positive way for me. And that values, and coming back to my values, was, well, what makes me feel right? Like, there's an inner voice that's so easy to just drown out with external things that if you listen, and it sounds a bit woo-woo and a bit hippie, but it helps me that when you listen to what you should be doing, well, what feels right? You know, what feels right with your business? What feels right with your family? You can start to tune in with those values. And a disassociation or a disconnected feeling is feedback that you're not feeling aligned with what you're doing or who you're spending time with or what you're doing in your daily activities or your daily work. But that's feedback, and you need to listen to it then. That feedback is failure is feedback, and you can course correct and you can adjust. And I'm not a person that's like, you know, do this, do this, do this. I can only tell you what works for me. And every time I feel that disconnection feeling with work or a platform I'm on or a conversation I'm having or meeting someone for a coffee or something I'm doing in my business, if I feel this internal, I don't feel right about that. I feel a bit disconnected with that. It's feedback that that's not what I should be doing. And then just running things through that filter.
I love that. It brings me back to, again, another lovely quote, which you have in your book. You mentioned, I had forgotten how easy it was to make physical changes in the world when one aligns one's mindset to allow the things you want to happen. Can you elaborate further on that, Brian?
I can. And the example that I use time and time again, because of my space, and I'm in that heavy, in that fitness space, is the way that I look. And I always think this is a funny one. As somebody that works with people on body composition, I do put up a lot of fitness content on my channels, and people will comment on me and how I physically look. And I'm happy with the way that I look. Again, relatively fit, lean muscle tissue, body fat. I spend, I'd say maybe 10 minutes a month, if even, on my fitness in terms of thought, in terms of thinking, in terms of food choices. It's all automatic at this point. My food, my training, my expertise, I'm way past my 10,000 hours of consuming and reading and working with people and working on myself, that it's just automatic for me. And we're kind of at the point now with business where a lot of that is automatic as well. I intuitively know this works, this doesn't work. This is connecting, this isn't connecting. You kind of get this weird sixth sense. It's that, you know, Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hour rule. I know people contest it on either side, but like there's some truth in that, that if you do something for long enough, you'll get this sixth sense with it. I think it's Outliers, he talks about it. And that's how I feel with fitness. I don't even think about it anymore. It's just an automatic choices that I make in the way that I live. And when you align your mindset and start to make those things automatic over time, and that's all they are, they're just habits. Tell me what you do every day and I'll tell you where you'll be in a year. You start to align your daily habits based on where you want to go. Physical changes around the world just kind of happen. Your body goes in a certain direction in terms of how it looks. Your business earns a certain amount of revenue in terms of the way you're showing up and the service you're providing. You have strong relationships because of your presentness and being fully tuned in and connecting and communicating. All these things that, as I said, there's people much better in the world doing them, but I subjectively think I'm doing okay with them myself as well. So that, and just constantly coming back to it, is key. And I think, to be honest, anybody can do that if you're checking in enough with it. And as I said, I don't want to preach either because there's better people to speak on the topic, but it is something that works for me.
You mentioned habits there, and you mentioned habits throughout all of your books and the importance of habits, and you know, the habits that you've now cultivated in your life really have formed the person that is now presented in front of me. And you know, you mentioned in your book, first you make your habits and then you make, you know, and then your habits make you. And I love that. For our listeners today whose habits may not be serving them, where should they start, Brian, in terms of, you know, cultivating the habits for them to scale sustainably so that actually they can maintain, you know, good health, both physically, mentally, and ultimately bring the right energy into the business? And I know that's a very wide-ranging question, but, you know, again, I'm always encouraging people who listen to this to take away something practical. So if there's only, you know, one thing for them to take away today, you know, where do they start in terms of checking in on their habits?
Well, firstly, awareness is the first step towards change, but too many changes too soon is a recipe for failure. And that tends to get people knocked off the runway of how long it takes to create a new habit. I think the University of London says it takes about 66 days to form a new habit. So there's a little bit of science behind it, but of course some will be shorter, some will be longer, but it's within that 2 to 3 month realm in terms of a habit change. And making too many changes too soon normally leads to overwhelm and people falling off track before they've had the time to build that habit. Whether that is committing to social media, whether that is changing up your diet, whether that is doing something for your business to scale, if it's too much too soon, you're not going to be able to stick to it over the long term. And those small, seemingly insignificant changes compound positively over time, as long as you have what you're doing is aimed in the right direction. So I would determine first and foremost, well, what's the habit? I think breaking a bad habit is actually harder than introducing a new habit. And you know, old habits die hard. And the analogy I use in books, it's like digging up a seed from the ground. Like you go outside and you planted a seed yesterday, you can dig it up quite easily. A sapling takes a little bit more effort. An oak tree is fucking hard to knock down. Like, so that's what habits are like. So if you've been doing something for 20 years, it's considerably harder to break than something you started doing for a year. So you need to align your expectations accordingly in terms of your runway time to change that habit. So again, there's better people out there to speak on this. I do speak about habits in my book, Atomic Habits by James Clear, Power of Habit by Charles Duhigg, two great books on the topic. And I think there's a lot to be learned in that. And habits are so funny. And the analogy I use, and this is the weird thing that connected with my first book, The Fitness Mindset, because you never know in a book what's going to connect with people. But there's in the habit section of that first book, I talk about putting on your opposite shoe in the morning to show you how hardwired your habits are. That I bet, and people listening to this, think about it for tomorrow. I bet you put on either your left or your right shoe every morning. It's the same shoe, same order, and you don't even think about it. It's just automatic. And that's the power of habits. Other people will have this when they're driving to the office on a Saturday, where you're just gone into default autopilot mode and you just have this habit and you start driving to the office on a Saturday when you're like, oh, what am I doing? I was supposed to go to the supermarket. They're habits that are hardwired, and it shows you how they can be really serving if you get them right. But contrarily, they can be very detrimental if they're aimed in the wrong direction. So just make sure that you're choosing them accordingly.
Yeah, I love that. And again, you have a great nod to Charlie Munger in your book as well. You dedicate a whole chapter to the power of compounding. And I encourage people to read that and to, I mean, our listeners will be aware of compounding, but especially in relation to habits. You know, you mentioned kind of putting your shoes on the opposite way. Something I started a number of years ago was brushing my teeth with my left hand. Initially it was like, this is really hard. Now you just do it instinctively. But and it also actually, you know, that trying to do something different, it brings you into the present moment. I find, you know, now you're not on automatic pilot anymore. It really makes you present. So I love that. The power of questions, and clearly you get this from your mom. I love that question that she posed to you. What would you do for free? But there's also a question that you pose in the book. What would I do, have, or be right now if I knew I couldn't feel? Do you think that question is the starting point for people to really develop and seed a new mindset which serves their desire to scale?
I think it depends on their starting point. If they suffer with imposter syndrome or a lack of confidence, yes, 100%. Because you do have people on the other end of the spectrum that have an unbelievable amount of confidence, although they mightn't have achieved a lot. And they're the people who don't tend to benefit from that exercise or that thought experiment. But if you're struggling with imposter syndrome or self-worth issues or self-confidence, asking what you could do, be, or have if you knew you couldn't fail is the first step towards removing your ego from the situation and removing yourself from the situation and seeing what the actual possibility is. And then it's just course correcting and navigating towards that. So I think it's a very, and I still do this as somebody that wouldn't have had the most natural self-confidence or self-esteem. I had a little bit of issues with that in my earlier life. And that was my initial switch off from, okay, remove Brian Keane from this. What could I do, be, or have now if I knew I couldn't fail and I didn't have this fear of failure and this fear of what people would say and what would happen if I had to go tail between my legs because I couldn't get my business off the ground or I couldn't scale it or I couldn't do whatever, all these things I struggled with, that removes that. And it then at least gives you a little bit of a North Star that you can work towards because it's not about you and your insecurities and your ego anymore. It's about what's possible if you remove that. And then you just spend, for me, I spent the next several months, several years trying to build up that confidence and remove that self-esteem issues and using and anchoring myself with more tools by reading books and coming through courses and doing programs and all of these things that helped me and just that minimized my learning curve so that I could actually get the thing that I wanted at the end, which I've been very fortunate with for the most part.
I'm going to come back to confidence in a moment because you use the analogy of kind of strengthening the table by building the confidence legs. But something I want to pick up on just to bring different parts of the conversation together. And, you know, when we think of the fact that 99% of those leaders of SMEs, 5.7 million in the UK, and that, you know, there's 400 million SMEs across the globe. And given that the UK is one of the easiest countries in the world to do business in, I suspect that that figure is actually less when we look at it across the globe. So lack of ambition, we know that entrepreneurs don't lack ambition, but they arrive at a point where something happens. How does that fear typically show up, Brian? What should people be aware of in terms of the inner voice? What will be going on in there which will resonate with listeners when you kind of you share the kind of things that will happen to prevent you moving beyond this current impasse?
I can't speak for other people, but I can tell you the internal dialogue that went on for me. And that was a very embodied story or a very vivid story that is something that other people do. And yeah, that was my language. And setting up a business for me initially as somebody that grew up in the west of Ireland on a farm and was in that safe, secure path of get a job, get a 9-to-5 in the case of teaching. And setting up a business was something other people did. So my version, and it was obviously an ego protection version, of that story was that's something other people do. I had the same thing happen with bodybuilding. I grew up idolizing Arnold Schwarzenegger and I always wanted to do a bodybuilding show and I always wanted to run a marathon. And they were things that quote unquote other people did. So the same story showed up in different areas. And that's what that fear came from for me. And again, I can't put words in other people's mouths, but you probably have your own version of this. And a good thought experiment that I use personally is what advice would I offer if this wasn't me? And that normally makes me see that this is my own subjective bias. And if I'm like, well, that's something other people do. I don't have the courage. What would happen if I fail? All these things. I'll go, okay, what if you were offering this advice to somebody else? Would you still have the same opinion on it? And in a lot of cases, like, no, actually, the advice I'd be telling you would be go do that thing. You should. You have a calling for it. You feel like you should. But when we're attached to it, it feels like, oh no, I can't do that. And that's why it's so important to get your mindset right. You know, I use the analogy in the book, don't let your biggest enemy live between your two ears. It's a quote attributed to Buddha. I don't know who it's from originally, but it's normally attributed to Buddha. And I think that's how business and scaling tends to be. Your own biggest enemy is between your two ears for the most part, because if you can get out of your own way, you tend to be able to do the things that you want. And if that's what you need to focus your attention on, then that's what you do. I can give you tactics for social media. I can tell you how to run a sales funnel. I can tell you how to bring your business online and grow it and scale it. But none of that matters if you don't really believe you can do it or you don't have the confidence in yourself to do it. So those tactics mean nothing if your head isn't right and your mindset isn't right in the first place.
Yeah, someone once shared with me, if it came down to knowledge, everybody would be in the shape that you're in. Everybody would have six packs and be millionaires. But ultimately, it comes down to taking action and actually doing the doing. So it would be remiss of me not to ask someone who is a global authority on fitness and healthy living and lifestyles, what can you share with our listeners, CEOs, leaders of businesses who are living a challenging, chaotic lifestyle for the most part, dealing with lots of stress, and especially given the current outlook, what steps can they do? What are the fundamentals, Brian, that we need to be aware of as business leaders in terms of making sure we're maintaining a healthy lifestyle?
It's such a great question. And I do a lot of corporate speaking around this topic. And back when I used to do one-to-one personal training, I was working with a lot of corporate executives before I transitioned out. And the answer is the same. And it's that there are things you can do that will have a positive impact on everything you do. And I'm biased as a fitness person, but nutrition and sleep are the two things that if you get right, has a positive impact on everything else in your life. Your productivity, your focus, your energy levels, your presentness, your health, your wellness, all of these things. And they can feel hard because I totally get it that when you're busy and when you're a high achiever and you've got a meeting after meeting after meeting, and you don't, again, I know I've got my life set up for the way I want to live it. Not everybody has, and not everybody wants to do what I have or do what I, the way that I live. But with nutrition, that's literally the fuel you put into your body, which is so funny. When I see, and used to work with corporate executives, and I've said this at wellness seminars, when you walk into a car park and there's all Audis and BMWs, I'm like, none of you would put fucking water into your fuel car, in the car. I was like, no, I was like, I've seen all those 2022 Audis and BMWs. I was like, not one of you are putting fucking water or Lucozade into your car. You're putting petrol and diesel into your car, but yet you're eating crap food and that's going into your body, which is giving you the fuel that you need for your energy through the day. And a lot of people, they'll have that response, they'll have a laugh, and then they think and go, oh, actually, that's a fairly good point. That's I never thought about it like that. And sleep is the same. And something I've been trying to change the conversation around is, particularly with high achievers, it's not about the quantity of sleep you get, it's about the quality of sleep you get. I put this in the last book, that's very heavily fitness, The Keen Edge, Mastering the Mindset for Real Lasting Fat Loss. But it's about the quality of sleep. So 6 hours of uninterrupted sleep is better than 9 hours of broken sleep. So you're focusing on that high quality sleep, getting your rapid eye movement, your REM sleep, your in-REM sleep, non-rapid eye movement sleep, getting that balance right so that you're feeling good. You've got everything balanced hormonally, energetically, you know, your body, even cravings so that you can make better food choices. Those two things go hand in hand. And you're making, Tim Ferriss says it on his podcast, what's the one decision that eliminates 100 decisions? And I would flip that a little bit and go, well, what's the one change that will have 100 changes and will spiral out in a positive way? And nutrition and or sleep work in that way because they impact everything else from productivity and focus to health and wellness. And I think looking at that from my background and expertise is something that tends to yield so much progress and positive impact for something that, yes, can be difficult to change in the beginning, but has a very positive compound effect over time, as we mentioned earlier with the compound effect.
Yeah, I love that. And I always say to people, look, do what makes good sense. And I use the acronym SENSE. I've written an article on this, you know, sleep, exercise, nutrition. I band nutrition and hydration together. The second, the acronym, S is self-care, and then having an enduring growth mindset. And you know, just for me, those things come up time and time again. And again, when you have that sense of awareness, you'll check in on, well, how do I feel when I woke up after 7 hours sleep versus kind of 4 hours sleep or 5 hours sleep? You know, the energy levels are just so different, and how you present and show up is so different. I'm curious, before we get into our close, what does your morning and evening routine look like?
Weirdly, my morning routine hasn't changed a lot in the last several years. I get up quite early, not as early as I used to. I was very much a heavy on the 5 a.m. club and the 4 a.m. club for quite a while, particularly when I was book writing. and I didn't want it to affect family life and things along those lines. I get up now around 5, 6 a.m. and I work out first thing in the morning. I literally give myself that half an hour of listening to a podcast in the morning, normally a business podcast, and then I train for an hour and a half, depending on my schedule. And then I do my creative tasks in the morning. So podcast recording, book writing, anything that's creative, I'll do in the morning. So that's what my Monday to Friday routine generally looks like. And my evening routine is the complete opposite. It's my goal for the evening routine is to switch off and to get my, because my mind tends to race at nighttime. I think a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of type A personalities will have this. It's not thinking is the problem. It's overthinking. It's actually that it goes too far into the extreme.
I can relate to this.
Yeah, exactly. So my whole 2 hours before I go to bed is about switching off. So, you know, if it means watching something on TV, I'm big on live sports. That's my escapism. Like I feel I'd watch two Indian, you know, under 12 Indian boys league kick a football if it was on at 8 o'clock in the evening. I'm like, awesome, put that on. And so I use live sports generally, or family time if I'm with my partner or if my daughter's there, depending on the schedule and what we're doing. Like just something that disconnects me from work and disconnects me from media. I don't go on my phone first thing in the morning. I don't go on my phone 2 hours before bed. I'm away from my laptop. I'm away from everything that's digital. I have that digital detox every evening, and then it normally helps with my sleep that night.
Brilliant. Brian, it's a question that I pose to all my guests in closing. You've had such an incredible life and you're such a young guy. You're, you know, you're only getting started and yet you've achieved so much. What three timeless takeaways would you leave with our listeners?
Firstly, thank you so much for having me on, Brendan. I've loved this chat. But the three tips I'd give, and they tie in, and I've used a lot of quotes in this podcast, but I tend to find that quotes and metaphors and figurative expressions tend to connect with me, and they tend to connect with other people as well. And I think to tie everything we said together, obviously the don't forget the flowers at your feet when you're reaching for the moon is important. I think that's one for the listeners of this show in particular, because of the high achieving nature of everyone that's listening. It's something that can happen if you're not aware. So I would keep that in mind. When it comes to habits, I think it's normally attributed to Seneca, but sometimes it goes to other Stoic philosophers, of form good habits and then become a slave to them. I think that's a good way to look at habits. You know, choose the ones that are going to support you and then become a slave to them. Let them become automatic, and then obviously break the ones that aren't. And then to tie in with Charlie Munger to finish it off with the habits, is the chains of habits are normally too strong to be broken until, or they're too weak to be broken until they're too strong to be changed. Or it's a version of that. Or Robin Sharma's, you know, who will cry when I die? And pulling it back to what's important to you, what's valuable for you, what are you doing in your life every day that is at your highest value, but ultimately pull it back to, well, who's going to cry when you die? And that makes what can be a complicated world with so many people to please and so many people to provide service to and so many things to do, narrows it down. Well, who's going to cry when you die? And then once you ask that question, you know where you need to focus your time, energy, and attention, and make sure that those relationships are where they need to be. Because ultimately, at the end, and I talk about this in Rewire Your Mindset, your 97-year-old deathbed, what would you regret more? There's a good chance you're not going to regret doing all those emails. There's a good chance you won't regret those 80-hour weeks, or you'll regret those 80-hour weeks, but you could regret not spending time with your loved ones. You could regret spending and saying yes to all these things that actually were out of alignment with who you wanted to be and what you wanted to do. So ask who will cry when you die, and then do that 97-year-old regret. What would you regret on your deathbed? And that can work as a North Star, or at least a filtering for where you should be focusing and aiming your direction and attention towards that North Star.
Those are brilliant, Brian. Really, really profound. I'll not put you in the spot and ask you what's next. But for, but for those who want to connect with you, and undoubtedly there'll be lots who will after this, to add to your incredible social media following, where best to reach you, Brian?
Oh, amazing. Thanks so much. Yeah, as Brian Keane Fitness and everything, I'm on literally every platform except for LinkedIn, weirdly. We don't put as much content on that, although that will be something we'll be doing. But Facebook, TikTok, Instagram, the podcast, the Brian Keane podcast, that's my baby. It's the thing I love to do when we do. Even if there was nobody listening, I would do that podcast. I love it. So that's something we've been very fortunate to grow. But I'm on everything as Brian Keane Fitness.
Yeah, brilliant. And look, I have to acknowledge the huge value you bring to the world. I mean, I encourage people to get over to Brian's podcast, buy the books. I've read two of them, gifted the fitness mindset a lot. I'm going to be gifting this, Rewire Your Mindset. Brian, well done on everything that you've achieved and done to date. Incredible. And it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show today. And I wish you all the very best in the future. Take care.
The pleasure was all mine. And I know you're doing incredible work between the keynote, between everything you're doing with the programs and the podcast, just serving those people and scaling up. So Brendan, keep doing what you're doing as well. And thank you so much again.